for me, what I had to do is I had to realize that I needed a conscious effort at every step in the game. It goes back to Jeff Hayden. What fingers need to move where next? What's the next move? And don't make that move until you know exactly what it is.
Good morning, Tom Knight. It's so good to see your face, man. How are you?
I am good. So good to see your face. How are you?
I'm great, man. It's been a while, but I've just been looking forward to some time to catch up with you and just hear your amazing story and hear your journey as a musician and all the other crazy fun things you do.
They are crazy, but thankfully they are also fun.
That's it, man. So how are things these days? Are you staying busy?
I am staying busy. I'm still doing everything I was always doing back in the day, playing drums as often as I get. I've got my sticks here. I've got a practice pad right next to me. And anytime I have a break in the day, which is a lot, you know, I work from home like a lot of people, but my primary positions in the daytime are revolve around digital marketing. And I do that for a couple of different companies. I still teach. Mostly on Zoom, although I have had a couple of students come through. Got two drum sets right around the corner here. But I think I'm gonna keep the Zoom as the sort of the primary vehicle for lessons. I still work out like crazy, and I'm considering getting certified by NASM so that I can offer courses. I think people our age might have an interest in living even longer, and I think, you know, exercise and fitness and good eating is a big part of that. So let's see, what else? I still do voiceover. I know you're not showing video, but I'm throwing my Rode microphone in front of the camera right now. Still do a lot of voice work, and and then spending as much time as I can in and around all of that with my three unbelievable boys. They're the delight of my life, man. Yeah. Best thing I ever did.
I understand that, man. And it's just, as you know, time certainly, it just gets faster the older they get. So having every second with them is just the most crucial thing we can do.
Absolutely. And it's the concept of lasts that gets me, right? It hurts you right in the heart, but it's a beautiful thing. But you just never know when that last time you're going to pick up that child, or that last time that, you know, he's going to, or she is going to ask you to play a board game or something like that. So I am always aware of that. Not to cast any kind of negativity over every day, because that sounds like it could be very sad, but I do. I keep it in mind, and what it does is it helps me, first of all, always say yes, and then secondly, just realize that, you know, being in the moment, because I think about sometimes when something happened for the last time and I wasn't aware of it, and you think back and you go, wow, if I had known, I would have maybe been even more present. I would have, you know, really focused. I would have soaked it in, maybe somehow even recorded it, you know, with our digital technology, you know, anything. And so I'm aware of that, you know, and I really try to, I spend as much quality time with them as I possibly can.
Yeah, I understand. As we're recording this, I'm about a month away from us heading down to LSU for Skylar's senior recital.
Wow. I remember when he got in.
Yeah. He's graduating in May. And it's unbelievable how quickly this all happens. And then just as you're talking, to be present in the day-to-day, but then always acknowledging that overlying, arc of time that you're enjoying every moment, but then seeing the big picture of their life and instilling good, you know, good things into their soul, so when they go out, they're going to be good human beings and treat others with respect.
Yes, you know? Absolutely. Absolutely. No, that's great. Wow. That's going to be an amazing trip for you.
Yeah, I'm excited and just kind of, I'm so excited for him. And, but at the same time, I'm just a little bit sad.
Oh yeah. You know, yeah, because it's, absolutely.
It's just, again, as you talk about those last moments, it's, mm-hmm. that's one of those things to check off the list. And,
right.
And he's going to be kind of on his own now. So it's kind of crazy. So
yeah, it is.
So you and I met playing together at Mount Pisgah, mm-hmm. and I will remember. I remember the first time I heard you play in person and played with you. I just remember thinking, "Oh my, listen to this guy play!"
Oh man, thank you.
Just fantastic. Player, everyone that's heard you certainly echoes my thoughts, and yeah, it's just it's always been a pleasure to get to stand next to you and
lock into what you do.
Man, it's so good.
Well, you make it easy. You know, you're helping me hold that bottom end down, man, and it was just as much of a pleasure for me, man. I really appreciate you saying that, and I feel the same way. You know, it was an amazing rhythm section, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. We were really lucky. Just a good core band that we got to play with every week. And mm-hmm. it was a good experience for me. I learned a lot by being with you and Bill Hatcher and Tim. And it was just a good band. And we had so much fun.
We did.
Yeah.
You know, some of the simpler music that would, you know, maybe you would want to just sort of breeze through and not think about. We would always ask ourselves, how can we make this, you know, even better? How can we make this funkier? How can we make this cool? What can we stick in here that we can sneak into the music and maybe, you know, elbow a couple of congregation members in the, you know, in the ribs? Hey,
yeah,
you know, do you hear this? You know, we'd sneak little bits of pop tunes somewhere in there and just hope someone notices. I mean, we had so much fun on that gig, man.
It was
every part of it, on and off stage.
Yeah, it was great. It was it was a lot of fun, and I cherish that time. So I want to kind of go back and get some just talk with you about this journey you've been on as a this one facet, big part of your life as a drummer, and find out how all that started for you and the development into the player that you are. How old were you when you had an interest in playing drums?
I was 6 years old. I was in the first grade, and we lived at the time in Decatur, Georgia, over here in Avondale. Not far from where I would live most of the rest of my life from that point on, with only about a year and a half in Chicago. Everything else was right here in Georgia. And we lived next to I lived next to a kid who was 16 years old. So I was not allowed to play with him. I was not allowed to, you know, go over. But I would sneak over when my parents, you know, weren't home or whatever. And he would let me in, and I would just sit there and watch him play his drums. He had like a silver sparkle drum set, and I used to just gaze at that thing like it was a diamond mine. You know, it was just the prettiest thing I'd ever seen. I don't remember at all what he sounded like, but I do remember sneaking over there and just sort of staring at that thing and going, wow, you know, one day. And I think my parents must have picked up on that somehow and said, okay, we need to put a stop to this. So they got me one of those toy drum sets, you know, I don't know, $30, you know, plastic junks, but it's a drum set, right? And they got it from Lionel Playworld. If anybody is old enough to remember Lionel Playworld,
I remember that place.
And man, so I think I got it for Christmas, and you know, they stuck it in the basement, of course. It was really more of a crawl space, but you know, hey, that's where they were going to put something noisy. And Jeff Hand, that's the kid's name I forgot to mention. His name is Jeff Hand, the kid that was older than me, right next door. He comes over to our place and proceeds to beat that thing to death. And there was almost nothing left of the little plastic heads after he was done with it. And but I was just proud that this kid next door came over and blessed my drums, you know. and I kept the cymbal from that old drum set for years. Like, the rest of it went away, but I kept that cymbal. It was like a little riveted cymbal, and it you know, barely crashed, but I held on to it. And for some reason, and the sticks, and I would just every once in a while kind of get them out over the years and beat around on pillows and things like that. And again, just that symbol was always there as sort of a, well, a symbol, no pun intended, for what would eventually become my, you know, life's love. And then in the sixth grade, I picked up the snare drum. I was finally able to join the band. I did 2 years of clarinet prior to that because they wouldn't let you at that age play drums, but I still wanted to be in the band. So I played clarinet for 2 years and I developed a pretty decent ability behind, you know, with that, but wasn't my love. So in the sixth grade, we got a snare drum, rent to own kind of thing. Ludwig 10 lug, 5 1/4 by 14 Superphonic, still have it. And yes, moved from clarinet to snare drum. And man, that was it. It was on at that point. And that was in the sixth grade, seventh grade. We didn't have middle school back then. So seventh grade was the end of your elementary years. So I had 2 years of elementary and then 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 were all high school. So I had 5 years of Melvin J. Hodges Jr. As my band director and kind of personal musical coach. And, you know, he thrust me and everybody in that band into everything. We were asked to play in the marching band. If we could do concert band, if we could be a part of the any kind of choir, you know, choral music, if in the drama club, if there was a band you needed for, we would do Grease or other, you know, plays, and we were encouraged to do that. The jazz band that had some pretty tough seats to fill because, you know, all the seniors were in that group. But by the time I got into the 11th grade, I was able to take over the drum set chair when Jerry Hansen, the almighty Jerry Hansen, graduated. I got the drum chair for 11th and 12th grade at Stone Mountain High School Jazz Band. and man, that, you know, I had private lessons along the way, of course. Was lucky enough to have grandparents who were really encouraging of my musical endeavors and paid for a lot of those, you know, first couple of years anyway, worth of drum lessons. And then, you know, ended up going to Georgia State and, you know, playing in those ensembles. And you know, and then somewhere in through all that, of course, you find your own. I found my own inspiration. So I wasn't just learning what the teachers were teaching. I had my own interests, right? Just like you would imagine. And, you know, those guys were like Neil Peart from Rush, Buddy Rich, of course, when it came to jazz, was number one for me. John Bonham, you know, and his right foot and abilities to sound like it was almost like a double kick, you know, situation, but it wasn't. It was just a single 26 inch bass drum.
Just that massive sound. Yeah.
And an incredible foot. Yeah. That's so that kind of, I would say, walks you from like, say, six to 16 or 6 to 18, you know, somewhere in that age range.
Who were you studying privately with during high school?
So my first drum teacher was a guy named Sherwood Mobley. And I still have, he had the best way of teaching. He would divide our little half hour lessons, 15 minutes of snare drum, 15 minutes of drum set. And somehow in that time, we would cover a lot of rudimental technique and reading, but he would also, he had me buy a manuscript book and he would take a little bit of time somewhere during in there and very quickly scratch out some rather complex drum set rhythms. I didn't recognize how difficult they were at the time. But when I go back and look, and by the way, I still have the book and it's dated, like he dated it. It goes back to 1981. So we're talking, you know, 40 plus years ago. And they're not the kind of exercises I would throw at a first year student, but he was daring to do that. And I just loved him for it. You know, he was one of the best teachers I ever had, first teacher I ever had. He died not long ago. In fact, I got what, you know, Facebook gives you the memories, you know, it was about 5 or 6 years ago, just the other day. And he had died. And I made a post of, you know, just expressing all the gratitude and love that I can for him, because he was my first teacher ever and the only teacher I had throughout high school. And, you know, of course, I took a picture of, you know, some of those handwritten exercises and, you know, a photo of me back in the day and then, you know, looking like a little boy. But yeah, that's Sherwood Mobley. There was the Sherwood story behind Mobley. I used to drive up on Saturday mornings. Well, my mom would drive me up on Saturday mornings at 11 o'clock to one of the DeKalb College campuses here in Georgia. And they opened up those lesson rooms on the weekend for us. So yeah, it was great, man.
I think there's a lot of value when an instructor doesn't let on to their student that what they're teaching them is difficult. If they just present it like, you should know this. There's immediately like I think as a student, we kind of put up a wall. If we feel like something is difficult, maybe we kind of realize that, oh, it's hard. I don't have to work so hard on this because I know this is difficult. But, mm-hmm. but as a, if a teacher presents something to you and says, oh, you should be able to do this. Yeah. Okay. Then I'm going to do it. And, that's a really cool, valuable lesson I think he was teaching you during those private lessons.
Oh, I totally agree. You know, we will rise to the occasion. I have found that my children rise to the occasion if I do the same thing. You know, it's hard sometimes to know where that, you know, where to kind of draw that line. And I'm definitely more the kind of father. I was always the kind that this kind of teacher that was probably more lenient than any of the teachers I had, which is weird. You know, you always hear that, you know, one of the maxims in psychology is we act as we were acted upon. But for me, it was always different. I really appreciated the strength and the kind of the staunchness of the lessons I was taught. But I always sort of leaned toward leniency. When it came to that, not to say that they weren't lenient, not to say that they were not understanding, but for some reason, I don't have that kind of, you know, punch. You know what I mean? I'm having a hard time describing what I'm saying, but so for me, it was a little bit different as a teacher and as a father. So I bring that back to knowing where to draw the line. Sometimes I worry, oh, am I going to be too tough on him, you know, or am I going to be too tough on the student and my kid, you know, but I have noticed that they will rise to the occasion, and they will.
They will.
And yeah.
I think we, you know, you and I grew up in a different time too. And I had instructors that, I'm not going to lie. I had a couple times where I would be in tears in a private lesson because I had a pretty intense teacher at a point. And, you know, and while it was probably effective, you know, I think our approach now may be a little bit of a reaction to what we maybe in the swinging in the opposite direction of what we were seeing as we were, you know, in our formative years.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. You know, that could very well be. I don't think any of the traumatic experiences that I felt was usually brought on by my own frustration. So one of the things I was going to say about Sherwood Mobley's handwritten drum set instruction, I do remember like it was yesterday because I still go through this. I just don't respond the way I'm about to describe. But it was when I was a kid, you know, I do remember putting his sheet music on my little rickety stand and you know, setting about working on it so that I would be able to check it off on the next lesson a week later, and just being so mad that I couldn't get it. I would throw my sticks across the room and just be angry. But then I would wander over within minutes and pick them up. Because that's the one thing that I would say about my personality is I hate being defeated by something like a piece of music. I hate the idea that you just can't do it. No, yes, you can. Go, come on, let's keep going, you know? Yeah. And so I would be my own, kind of my own worst enemy or my own best drill sergeant. I just wouldn't let up. So the frustration that I felt was always brought on by my own angst, never by the teacher. And so, yeah, I don't know where it is, but I have a much softer heart when it comes to the students that I teach, because I can't bring myself to be that mean. If I ever saw a student like shed a tear, I would go give him a hug or something. Like there's no way. I would feel so bad. I'm not built that. I'm not built that way. I can't do it. You know, I can't.
And that could have been it for me. I think I may have been so frustrated with myself that was just the only way I could react to it was just to, you know, just get emotional about it. You know, it was never a taskmaster tyrant teacher situation. But, you know, I have heard stories about back in the day when band directors would throw music stands and things like that. I mean, that kind of stuff was going on.
Yeah. The movie Whiplash. Right. Exactly. You know, a lot of people asked me, you know, of course, because I'm a drummer, you know, was it like that? Absolutely not. I have to say, as much as that movie was a lot of fun to watch, I don't have any experience with that. You know, I didn't have any teachers or band directors or any, even sometimes you would have like they would assign one of the students as a section leader, for example, you know, and if we were ever going to see any example of that sort of behavior, it would have I would wager that it would have come from a teenager, right? Not a fully grown adult. And we did have some that were close, but yeah, it was nothing like that, man.
Yeah.
It was nothing like that. Thankfully. Well, good. I'm glad you didn't. I'm glad it wasn't the tyrant teacher. You know.
Yeah. I've heard stories, but yeah, fortunately, it was certainly was not my. I never had any firsthand experience in that. So.
Mm, okay.
Well, what was your experience like? Did you study with Jack Bell at Georgia State?
I did, yes. And now, he was definitely no tyrant, but he was very, very strict. And I'll give you a perfect example. We had our first private lesson, and it was more of a going over of how things would be, right? This is what we're going to expect you to be able to do, and this is how lessons work, you know. And he had this rule that if you didn't get through a piece with three mistakes or less, it was just instantly assigned for the next week, right? You couldn't make more than three mistakes. And so there was an assignment made, and the next week, you know, I come back and he's sitting right next to me, and he's on the clock, man. And so I'm setting my music up, and I'm sort of getting my sticks out of the bag, and he starts counting with his sticks. He counts, you know, and I'm just thinking he's just, I don't know, warming his hands up, or he's just giving me a tempo that he's going to, and he starts counting me in. And of course I'm not quite ready, and I didn't hit the first note. And he goes, "That's one." And I immediately realized where I was and what this meant and how this was going to go, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't a tyrant. It was just professional. Oh man, we are no longer in grade school. He's treating us like a professional would treat us. And certainly how they were, I think he was working under Yoel Levy at the time. And the stories about him were legendary in that same vein, you know, sort of an expectation of instant perfection. Yeah. Right. And he was very good at handling that himself. He thrived under that sort of discipline. And put it out on us. And I immediately learned, you best believe that never happened again. But he was great, man. Just an amazing instructor. Absolutely loved it.
I studied with him in high school, as did my son. And he's intense, right? But it's good, right? It's you know that what he's telling you is working, and you know that it's planting seeds that will sow for forever. I mean, developing your sound, developing your touch. I mean, the guy can still, I don't know how old he is now, but the guy can still play circles around people. His hands are still amazing.
I have, to this day, never seen anybody play faster, cleaner paradiddles. And it's not about, you know, speed, of course, but the fact that he had such ability to that end, I had just never seen, and it was effortless. And of course, he, you know, taught us the secret of how it works for him. And the minute we employed it, all of our paradiddle speeds instantly improved. And it was really, for him, just more of a mindset approach. And so, you know, for that particular technique, like fastest paradiddles possible, right? And I think that's probably one of the things that I took away from him is mindset. You know, there's always a way to approach a problem that maybe you didn't think about. And Jeff Hayden, the piano teacher down there, still there. I used to take private lessons from him. I learned a valuable mindset lesson from him one time that I have been using ever since. I teach to this day, as to how to, more quickly get a technique together, you know, rather than just what I call crashing and burning, for example, where you just play it and it doesn't work. You play it and it doesn't work, and you play it 100 times. And then finally it does work and you don't know why. And you just hope that from then on, it's going to always work. You know, you've seen it, right? You just sort of attack it, like you tackle it, like, you know, literally. He had the exact opposite approach. You know, I was struggling with, it was just basic scales. Two octaves in right hand at the same time as two octaves in the left hand. And it's great on C major because it's just white keys, you know, thumb, one, two, thumb, one, two, three, thumb, one, two, thumb, one, two, three, and then back down. Well, F, Now we have a flat. That's suddenly not easy. It's not mirrored anymore. Instantly, one flat note, and it's instantly, it ruins the pattern for the hands, right? And I remember asking him, I was like, how in the world do you ever get this? And this was his secret. I'm going to go ahead and give his secret here. He said, just play it so slow that you can't make a mistake. Doesn't matter if it's not in time with a click. Who cares? What you're doing is you're training your neural pathways to fire in the right moment and in the right order. And so when you have something where one limb is doing something different from the other, which it is, in this case, just wait before you make a move. Freeze. Figure out what the next move is, then make that move. But whatever you do, don't make a mistake. And it cut down the time it would take me to learn each scale by hundreds of percents, right? Like, I could not believe it. Before long, my body was starting to take over. And that's what it's all about, right? You're trying to get your body to learn this stuff so you don't have to think about it so hard. But the crash and burn method, as I call it, where you just go for it and hope, that takes so much longer. And that's what I was doing. It's what a lot of students do to this day. And so I always talk about Jeff's approach. And the thing about it is it's really unsexy, right? It's so slow. It doesn't sound like anything. If you're worried that someone's standing outside the door listening, you're going to, you know, ooh, they know I can't do this. And wow, they probably think I suck. And look how slowly I'm doing. Who cares? So what? Because you're going to get that technique so much more quickly if you just hit it with that mindset, understanding that, you know, it's more about the correct order of events than it is the speed. Ironically, the speed comes more quickly the slower you attack.
Yeah. I think it's so easy to be so focused on the product and not focused enough on the process. Mm-hmm. And the process is most of the time is way more important than what the product is. And if you can iron out the process of it, the product is just going to be, it's going to happen automatically, right? Yeah, that's what a great way he taught that to you.
Well, I agreed. The other thing I got from it is that because it made the process so much, when you're talking about process, it made the process so much more fun, because even though it seemed like you were taking, you know, five steps backward, it was almost like the bow and arrow pull, right? You are pulling it back. You are going backwards. But man, when it finally clicks and you let go, now it's shooting through the air at lightning speed, right? So I learned to, another phrase, I learned to love the chase. To your point, it isn't always about the destination. If you can learn, because you're going to spend more of your time on a destination than you are at. Let me say that again. You're going to spend more time on the trip toward the destination, I think, than you are at the destination. You only run through the tape. You only hit the checkered flag in that moment, but it's everything that leads up to that, right? Why wouldn't we want to enjoy that process? Otherwise, it's just this arduous slog all the way up until the moment that you break the tape with your chest, and then what? It's over. No, on to the next. No, you got to learn to love the chase. And Jeff's teachings, and as did Jack Bell, and to some degree, my very first teacher, Sherwood Mobley, although I didn't have that thought process in mind yet. I was still hurling sticks across the room in rage. But I learned to love the chase, right? And so that made everything from that moment on way more fun. And I was able to apply that same principle to whatever else I was working on, you know, whether it was video production, marketing, voiceover, exercise even, you know, all the stuff that I would later embrace, I would take that same principle, those same principles, and apply them. And yeah, it always made the trip way more fun, and generally closed in on that destination much more quickly and effectively.
Yeah, man, that is fantastic. And such a great lesson to even as we get older, just to apply and to try to add into everything we're doing. I mean, I'm just thinking about it in terms of my day gig. I'm like, man, I need to be focusing that method just in my everyday life. It's really, yeah, really fascinating.
Yeah.
During all of this, its state, were you playing a lot of drum set there? Because I mean, you're insanely great drum set player, I'm wondering, were you playing in bands at the time? Were you what was that, and what were you studying on drum set while you were doing it?
Okay, cool. So yeah, I did play a lot of drum set. I was part of the jazz band there. It was, you know, me and, you know, Rob Clayton and David Henderson and maybe a couple of other guys, Joey Smith. Dylan Fusillo. These are names that, you know, if this podcast gets out there, they'll be like, hey, yeah, I remember that, you know. I was doing that. There were jazz combos, you know, little 3 and 4 piece groups. I also played in the pep band for the basketball teams, basketball games. Well, that was fun because it, you know, you got to do all kinds of cool things, you know, of course, and also see the games. But they also paid for part of your tuition if you did that, you know? And so that it was fun on a number of levels,
right?
Sure. Put it that way. And then, you know, of course you're studying all the percussion, but of course drum set was, you know, my love. And I tried not to let it dominate my thoughts because it would if I let it, but I had a number of outlets. I was not in any bands though. It wouldn't be until after I left Georgia State. I left about halfway through. I didn't graduate, got married, started working, you know, at the time. And then that marriage didn't work out. You know, it was almost like more of a breakup. We didn't have any kids or product. What am I saying? No kids, no property. That's the word I was looking for. And so it was more like a breakup, you know, not a big deal. And that's when I joined Skin Deep. That was the first band that would really challenge me in ways of drumming that I had not even encountered, despite all the teachers, despite all the opportunities I had in high school. And by the way, Melvin Hodges put me in the front of every spotlight he could. He was always throwing me in all these competitions, and I would always win them. You know, I don't mean to sound, you know, like I'm boasting. I'm not, but he put me in the limelight all the time. And then in college, I was being, you know, I even got to play at Georgia State. I forgot to mention this. I was a part of the faculty jazz ensemble that would go out and recruit at high schools because the drum teacher, Robbie Coleman, couldn't ever make those gigs. And so I was the guy that got the gig every single time the faculty band would go out. So you want to talk about being thrust into the fire with great musicians, man. Wow. Rick Burgess, Rich Nanista, you know, Hayden, Gordon Vernick, these guys are legends in their own right. And I had to, kind of like hanging on for dear life, man. But yeah, I say all that to say that it wasn't until I got to Skin Deep that I was challenged in ways that, believe it or not, none of those opportunities did. Talking about tearful moments, I remember I had to learn to sing in that band. I had never done that, even though we had to sight sing. You know, we did have to do sight singing. It's not the same. It's not the same as trying to sing with soul and tone and then, of course, in time and blending with other singers while playing drums. I mean, these are things that I had never done before. And then playing drums with a soulful, funky feel. I had been, you know, a rocker my whole life and then a jazzer and, you know, contemporary jazzer. I was like, wait a minute, I don't know how to do any of this. And I remember, you know, driving home from a Skin Deep rehearsal one time, just literally like tears in my eye, you know, like, I can't believe it. I finally bumped into something that I absolutely just can't do. But I kept at it. I kept at it. And one day it clicked. Can't explain it. You know, it's one of those things that just happens. You struggle. And then one day it's just there. And yeah, it's always there from that point on. And to the point where you don't even know why it wasn't there before. Like, wait a minute, this all makes sense to my body. I get it. How did I not get this? But you don't until you do. And that was the beginning of a whole new trajectory for my drumming. And from there, that's what led me to working with Dallas Austin and TLC and Monica and Stevie Nicks and all these other player artists, because Skin Deep was pretty well revered in Atlanta even before I was in it. I was not the first drummer of that band. Rob Clayton was the first drummer, a guy that I met in person at Georgia State. He started that band. And then when he quit, they asked me to play for them. And I had a huge shoes to fill because he was that guy who could play with feel better than anybody I knew. He could sing soulfully better than anybody I knew personally, especially drummers. And so I had a lot of things to live up to in that job, but it attracted the attention of Dallas Austin's crew. They signed the singer Terrence to Rowdy Records. We worked on that record. We ended up on Fled motion picture soundtrack. That was my first album credit, I think 1994 or something like that, you know, and my name's on, finally I can go buy a record and my name is on it, you know. And the rest is history, as they say, because Dallas would just continue to call for the next few years. And then, of course, that landed me the TLC tour. And I was their drummer for 11 years up until 2009, from 1998 to 2009. Played on two of their records, played on a Monica record, all thanks to Dallas's interest in me as a drummer. And then that from Skin Deep. So.
Yeah.
Sorry, I went all over the place there, but that's the good story.
It's so interesting to go back and think about you playing in that band and, you know, just the what it was setting you up for when you probably had no idea at the time that that's what was happening. And, you know, the growing pains you were probably experiencing as your in your musical development was just, yeah, raising you to this next level that you were about, that was going to give you these crazy new opportunities you had no idea was around the corner.
It's just absolutely amazing. I don't think I would have been anywhere near ready for a TLC tour, for example, had I not gone through the Skin Deep. You could argue that I wouldn't have gotten there if it weren't for Skin Deep in the first place, and that would be true. But let's say somehow alternate timeline, I ended up, you know, in the running somehow, but I hadn't had the Skin Deep experience, and all I would have been able to take to me on the to the audition, say, for example, if I was auditioning, would be whatever I had as a rock and a jazz drummer. I don't think it would have worked. I'm not saying that, you know, another rock drummer or jazz drummer couldn't have killed that gig. I just don't think I would have. And so, yeah, I do see it as all kind of part of the plan, if I may say, you know.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I didn't realize that you had dual responsibilities singing as well in that band. And I've done plenty of gigs over the years playing drums and singing. And it's, at least for me, I could never focus on one more than the other, because I would kind of get into this mental trap if I thought about one thing more than the other. What was it like for you?
So I had I know exactly what you're talking about. How do I want to tell this? Because I don't want to, I tend to talk around the subject because I have so many thoughts. Just the drumming. Let's talk about this. Just the drumming and the singing. same thing. If I focused on the drumming, the singing would fall away. If I focused on the singing, my arms and legs would forget what they're supposed to be doing, despite, you know, 15 years of work up to that point, you know. So the only way I was able to get through it was to approach it the way I had learned to approach everything else in my drumming, especially when it came to quote unquote four-way independence. I say quote unquote because I personally don't think that exists, and I'll talk about why if you're interested, because there might be some listeners out there going, yes, it does. I beg to differ, and I'll give those people the same challenge Jack Bell gave me that changed my mind about it all. But at any rate, how do you get four limbs, or now five limbs, if you count the voice, how do you get them to work at the same time? You have to think about everything as a whole. It never worked for me to just work on the singing and try to get that subconsciously happening so that I could like leave it alone and then just let it fly over top of my drumming. And the inverse is also true. I couldn't just work on a drum part until I nailed it and then let that happen underneath without any thought, and so that I could focus on the... Now, none of that ever worked for me. For me, what I had to do is I had to realize that I needed a conscious effort at every step in the game. It goes back to Jeff Hayden. What fingers need to move where next? What's the next move? And don't make that move until you know exactly what it is. It seems like you're going in slow motion, but it's the only thing that worked. So in other words, you're building the entire piece as you go. You're not just layering them like you would in the studio. You're literally building the whole thing from left to right, you know, the way you would read music. So I would just have to figure it out. Okay, when I hit this drum or this cymbal at this time, what note am I supposed to be singing? And let's do that. And I would just work on that little bitty piece, you know, and then I would add to it. I would add to that, and I would add to that. So at first, it seems like I was only practicing a beat or two beats at a time, and I would just loop that. Okay, what's the next beat I have to do? And what happens with my hands, feet, and voice? Let's add that. It was a really slow process in the beginning, because I'd never done it before. But that got me to the finish line, again, much faster than sort of praying that one of them would happen sort of automatically.
Yeah, that's it. And that was the way it was for me too, is developing it as a whole instead of two entities, right? It requires that solid approach to the entire thing instead of, and it's hard, right? Because it's, you're trying to work out the problems and the mechanics of it while still making it sound interesting and not mechanical. It needs to sound musical and it needs to have feel and dynamics. And there's a lot going on under the hood right there.
There is. And the lesson for me was it sounds like blasphemy, but in the beginning, I set aside musicality. I set aside feel. I set aside anything because it was about getting the firing in the right order, the firing of muscles, the breath support, whatever needed to happen when it needed to happen. That's what I was building. And then once you get things in motion and you can reliably, say, for example, play, you know, a whole chorus of whatever song with your drums playing what they're supposed to be playing, with the voice singing what it's supposed to be singing. Once we can reliably do that at will from having done sort of the robotic process, now we can then work on everything else. If there was any layering of anything at all, it was that. It was smoothing out the, you know, to quote Stephen King in his book On Writing, he talks about bulldozing and bricklaying. He bulldozes the first draft, meaning I don't care if this is perfect. I don't care if there's too many words or not enough. I'm bulldozing my way. And then I'll go back and then I'll lay bricks. And that's where we smooth things out. That's where we get rid of unnecessary verbiage. That's where we expound on themes or correct mistakes, whatever. I didn't know about that at the time. This is, you know, decades later that I would read that book, but it describes the process. I think that what I was doing, unintentionally, just, I was bulldozing. How can I get the mechanics down? And now let's go and bricklay. Now let's go and clean it up, make it pretty, work on tone, work on blend, you know, all that good stuff.
Yeah, that's great. No, that's a great concept to think about in this respect just kind of getting the technical piece out of the way so the music can happen. And it's a great approach to that. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Now you sparked my curiosity about the four limb independence. I think I'm, for the record, I'm going to have to get you to tell me your thoughts on it.
Oh, sure. I was one of those people who definitely believed, because there was certainly enough evidence in my own practice regimen to support the idea that, yeah, we really can, you know, set one limb in motion and then just sort of leave it and then go to this other limb and work on it and you know, and think about that. But only because of the fact that what we were working on made musical sense, right? One would be a fraction, an even fraction of the other, say, for example, 16th notes in one hand and, I don't know, eighth notes in the other, you know. They sort of work together, right? And so that gives us the sort of this false illusion, this false sense of ability that we really can, you know, play one limb independent of the other. I now no longer believe that and haven't since 1988, when Jack Bell, who asked me the question, do you think you're independent? And I said, yes. And he had this fold. So he goes over and writes this thing down and he comes over and he has it in his hand. He sort of ceremoniously presents it to me, you know, almost like an offering, you know. I take it out of his hand and I look at it and I hand it right back and I go, you know what? Wow, that blew my mind. And you're right. It can't be done. All the exercise was, it certainly wasn't musical. Remember what I was saying before about, you know, the reason why we think we can do this is because everything we've been taught and the types of stuff we read are musical. If we were truly independent, this exercise I'm about to tell you would not be a problem, except no one can do it. So we're not independent. Right hand, quarter notes, left hand, quarter notes, right foot, quarter notes, left foot, quarter notes. Here's the deal. They each have different BPMs.
Oh, 100, my gosh.
105, 110, 115. Take your pick, right? I don't know anybody who could even do two of those. If we truly had two-way, three-way, four-way, whatever independence, we could set that in motion. And by the way, you could. You could take four people and say, okay, here's your metronome. And as long as they were able to somehow shut out the sounds of the rest of the crew, they could absolutely keep time. But look at what we're talking about. Four different brains, okay? One brain, one brain stem. Not happening. So what that taught me in 1988 is that if I ever wanted to think about things that were complex, interbody rudiments, these sort of quote unquote interdependent, you're quote unquote independent. I say interdependent because the way I would approach it is like what I said, what's the next move? I think that's what Jeff Hayden was saying. What's the next move? Make the body do that. Because if you just try to learn one hand and then the other hand and then sort of zipper merge those two together, it sometimes works. Again, if it's a very simple combination, you know, like one is metrically related to the other. But man, if it's not, and a lot of Latin rhythms are like that, if it's not, you're going to have a real hard time. Now, what I'm seeing lately on social networks I am starting to see a little bit of veering away from what I'm saying. So I'm realizing that there is some limitation to my philosophy here. And what I'm seeing are people who have absolutely, do appear to have absolute command over independent rhythms. Having said everything I just said, I do see some freaks of nature out there who are able to play fives and sevens in opposing limbs and then four and two on the other. I'm curious as to how they learned it. I don't know that that's something you could step through the way I've described because of how they're so distantly related metrically. It may be that what they're doing is bona fide setting one limb free. The thing I'm saying I was never able to do, and you know, right? So I just said all that, and now here I am giving you an example of the contrary. Maybe they were really good at they just set one limb free, and they can work on the other four. I've seen that happen in my playing one time. I can give you one example where that happened to me, where I was able to play some metrically distant rhythms within the body, and I don't know how I'm able to do it. I can play a 4/4 beat. Like, so let's say you got a kick on, you know, kick on all fours, you know, and I can take my hands. Okay. Cause the kicks, the left foot's just holding the hi-hat closed. Kick is the right foot. Okay. So the only thing really happening in my feet is the kick drum. But my hands, I could take my hands, keeping the 4/4 beat, and bump it up to five over that two. So boom, dot, doom, dot, doom, dot, doom. Okay, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I can't sing it, but I can play it. I can bump the four up into a five, keeping that four note phrase, and then I just do it until it loops back down. And it sounds crazy. It's nothing musical. It doesn't sound good, but it's just something that I was always able to do, and it's purely accidental. And I could not imagine trying to figure that out slowly. I didn't even know. After preaching this whole thing of, you know, going through it one, you know, vertically, like what's the next move that all the limbs would make? Okay, do that. Don't make any mistakes. I don't know how in the world I would approach that. So, you know, I'm still learning. I say all that to say that I've got these very strong opinions that come from Jack Bell 40 something years ago that I believe. But at the same time, things are changing, you know, and they're becoming a little easier, I think, for drummers. And the more drummers see that happening, the more they're going to try it and the more easily it'll become second nature. And, you know, my way of thinking will eventually be phased out, you know, and, you know, future blogs or not blogs, future podcasts, you know, hundreds of years from now, they'll be talking about completely different things that we think are fantastic and impossible right now.
Well, and I think there's at least in terms of content and accessibility of YouTube and, you know, social media, whatever, there is so much, there's so much more of a, I feel like a, such an academic amount of content available now where that those concepts are on display and those players are on display, which breeds more and more people trying to, I don't want to maybe outdo is the correct word, but there is a lot of that going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a very strong point you just made. And it's true in every walk of life, if you think about it, right? I mean, you know, it's always about what's the next best, you know, we're always in any point in history on any topic, there's some level that's some bar that's been set, right? That the next generation is going to try and up the ante on. I mean, do you remember when the first commercial for the iPhone came out? It was not much bigger than a friggin' domino. It was tiny. And we all thought those commercials, they were leading up to the release that hadn't even been released yet. And we were looking at the commercials going, there's no way there's some phone out there that you can just touch with your finger and it does all this stuff, you know. And now we're shooting 4K video or better in our hands, you know, and editing and uploading them all from a very small device that we hold in our hands, where it used to take, you know, dozens of pounds worth of $10,000 computing power to do stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
Everywhere you look, it's always about how can we do this better? So it's no mystery to me why that's happening in music. You know, what's the next level of excellence, or what else can we do that we haven't done before? And on that note, I'm gonna throw one more thing out there. Did it ever occur to you, like when you would watch movies in the 80s or something like that, and they would have this sort of futuristic, you know, maybe it would be, you know, far into the future, you know, 50 years into the future, right? We're almost there. You ever notice that the music was just crazy sounding music? Did it ever occur to you? We never got there. Like somehow or another, as nutty as they would have the music back in those days, as representative of what they thought music might turn into given 50 years time, it never really got there. Like there's still some musicality, like there's still melody and still satisfying rhythms, and it doesn't sound awful like it does in the movie. They try to portray that it's going to be in the movies. You ever notice that?
Really funny you mentioned that. Yeah, I don't know if I had consciously thought about that very much until right now. I'm like, he has a good point.
I mean, I'm glad, because I remember thinking back then, I was like, God, I hope music doesn't sound like that when we get there. Personally, I don't like it. You know, maybe somebody watching the movie is like, oh, I can't wait to, you know, and they rushed over to their, you know, instruments and started immediately writing those kinds of songs. But we never got there, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, I don't know what that has to do with. I don't know what that has to do with one-upping the next drummer on Instagram, but you're getting a peek into my mind and how far off topic it can go at any given moment.
I love it. As time has gone on and you've had a lot of life has happened since your days touring, and you look back on that time of your life, what are your thoughts on it now as you're older? Were those great moments of your life just... What's your perspective on it now?
Oh yeah. I still say that time, musically speaking, job wise. Okay. TLC was the absolute best musical job I ever had. It allowed me to do all the things that I grew up thinking I wanted to do, you know, wishing I could do. You know, I wanted to play. I used to envision playing in front of huge audiences. I used to envision traveling all over the world. I used to envision, endorsing companies. It wasn't about free gear. I just wanted the recognition of my favorite, you know, drumsticks, for example. You know, where is it? Hold on. Yeah. Let me see if I can get that in there. It's somewhere in there. There it is.
Really
see it. It's kind of that's washed out. But, you know, my signature on a stick, you know, I got that. Yeah. You know, it was, and then be paid to do it. Oh, and then play with, you know, musicians that were way, way better than you in terms of musical caliber, you know, like, oh my goodness, that was the best band I'd ever played with. And then music that I actually enjoyed playing, you know, it was the best gig I ever had. Wouldn't trade it for the world. Sometimes I think I wish I'd have done things a little more intelligently when it came to finances. Anybody that spent their life in the music business knows that sometimes the music business doesn't actually look out for you, and you really need to, you know, get a handle on your finances and think about the future and investments and all that kind of thing. If I could go back and make any changes to that time, it would be to set aside something and use the time value of money to my advantage, right? With compounding interest, time is the most important component in that equation, right? I mean, unless you run into $1 million or more, you win the lottery or something like that, or some giant inheritance falls in your lap, that would kind of kickstart that. But look at what has to happen when you don't use time to your advantage. And I did not use time to my advantage. So, but again, I wouldn't trade that experience just to grow an account. I mean, life is meant to be lived, and I did, man. I mean, I got to do something that I always wanted to do, and that honestly, even today, is still a fairly rare thing to experience.
Yeah.
So I am eternally grateful, you know? I have mementos from that time. I've got, you know, the gold and platinum records from those albums that I played on. You don't get those for touring, but the touring sort of solidified to me the experience. So I got to do both. You know, I got to play on the record and then go and play the song that I played on the record live, you know, all over the world, that, you know, on multiple records. That was great. Those are experiences, you know, my kids will be able to talk about long after I'm gone, you know. Wouldn't trade them for the world.
Yeah, you know, you were fortunate to play with I would call them a genre-defining group. I mean, they changed the course of the music that they were playing and for the style that it was. And I think that music is, I still feel like it still sounds as fresh today as it was when it was released. It's really amazing how good and timeless those songs are.
I should send you, agreed, first of all. Yes, absolutely agreed. I should send you, I discovered a cassette tape of a board mix from 1999 when we were rehearsing at the Lakewood Amphitheater here in Georgia. I don't know what they call it now. It's something else, but you know, that was they needed a stage big enough to actually work out all the, you know, the lighting and projection and all that stuff. There was a board mix of pretty much an entire run through. The only thing missing from that is the girls' individual solo sections. They each had like 10 minutes. So there's a good 30 minutes that's not in there, but all the rest of the stuff, man. And I should send you a copy of Creep. That was because that's the song that got me interested in them. I, you know, it was 1994. I was driving my little truck with no air conditioning around 285, headed over to Ken Stanton by the Big Chicken to teach private drum lessons, you know, and I heard that song and I just could not believe, wow. Okay. I can't wait to hear that again, you know? And I remember saying, you know, to myself, just by myself in my truck, I was like, man, I'm going to play for them someday. And that was 1994. And then 5 years later, 1999, I'm in Tokyo at the Budokan playing that song with them as a headliner.
Wow.
Monica was the opening act, and the opening act before Monica was the warm-up act was a local artist in Japan named Yutada Hikaru that Vinny Kaliuta was playing drums for. So I got to hang out with him for a whole evening because we were staying at the same hotel. Vinny Kaliuta is playing for the opening act. Are you kidding me? Anyway, so... Again, my mind just goes everywhere. I should send you a copy of Creep because you talked about fresh. Man, the way that thing sounds with that band, whew. And what we did with it live, you know, you always make little changes. You know, we didn't like trick it out to where it's, you know, unrecognizable like sometimes happens. And, you know, the music director on that gig was something else, man. Eric Daniels. And the ideas that they brought, just phenomenal. And it all felt so good. Like it wasn't acrobatics. It wasn't musical acrobatics. It was musical stank, man. Just makes your nose crinkle, you know, just that good, that fresh. Again, best band I ever worked with. And it wasn't about, hey, check me out. It was performing for the ensemble, performing for the artist, performing for the for the fans, not for the musicians.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of video of you playing with them, playing live shows with them. And it's just oh man, just great groove playing. Oh, it's not.
Thank you.
It's, I mean, chops are there, and when it's needed, you hear it. But the song is always at the forefront of everything that's happening, and that's the key to it. And I think that's a testament to their success, but I think it's also a testament to your sound and the way you approach. And I felt that way every time I got to play with you. It's like there's so much more in the reserve under the surface that you know it's there when it's needed. But until then, I'm just going to play the freaking song. You know, it's really amazing.
Well, I did a lot of that, you know, in the, you know, my youth, right? You know, coming out of high school, you know, you suddenly run into Weckl and Vinny and those guys, right? And of course, you want to be able to do what you can't do and that sounds amazing and that you're blown away by, right? You want to be able to do those things. And so I worked on all that stuff. And then Adam Nitti came along and gave me the opportunity to actually do some of that stuff, which, you know, to be fair, I think a lot of that stuff was, you know, I stuffed too many notes in there, but I guess that's part of growth. You know, I don't regret any of it. It's some of that stuff landed me, you know, really good reviews in Modern Drummer, and gave me a little bit of a name back then in that world of, you know, fusion, contemporary fusion music. But by the time I got the TLC, I had been through Skin Deep, which was the exact opposite. I'll never forget Bill Buchanan, the bass player for Skin Deep. About a year or so before I joined, I think Rob was still in the band and, they weren't looking for a drummer, but he had heard about me. Bill had heard about me from Rob. Rob thought I was a great technician, even though I thought he was like the best field drummer I had ever felt, I had ever heard. He was very kind about my abilities, and he must have said something to Bill, and Bill said, you know, so one day they're at Georgia State, and Bill says, "Man, let me hear what you got," you know, sort of arm foldy. You know the deal.
Yeah. Oh, I know the look.
So I get behind the drums and I do my thing and I'm like throwing everything I can at him, you know, and I stop and he just looks at me. He goes, "Man, play me something I can dance to." And I was like, you know what? He's not wrong. He's not wrong. Nothing I played would resonate with mainstream. It sent me home kind of tail between the legs, not in a bad way, but I was just like, what am I doing? And at what point is this, you know what I mean? Like, you don't want to let some flippant comment from someone you don't even know get you down. That would be like today, a negative comment on a social post. You know, you wouldn't want to let that ruin your day. But at that age, it made me really think, okay, what am I doing? And so a year later, I would be in a band with this same guy. And he was very gentle. He's a really cool soul. I think he was just kind of acting up that day. But he was really instrumental, no pun intended, on getting me all of the musical library, giving me a musical library to use as subject matter, right, for redefining my role as a drummer. And so by the time I got to TLC, I had kind of re-sculpted my playing. And yeah, there's always an element here and there where I can pull some of that old stuff out from the Adam Nitti days, but it's icing. It's not even icing. You know what? It's not icing. It's like sprinkles on icing on the cake, right? That's not the point anymore. So, and that really helped, I think, the TLC.
I'm sure that more than once that little comment was in the back of your mind when you were playing. Just,
oh yeah,
you know,
absolutely,
play something I can dance to, or
know who
your listener is, know who your audience is, right? And I mean, yeah, there are a lot of ways you can articulate that, but it's ultimately, yeah, what does it need for the song, right? That's what a great, and I'm sure, yeah, I can imagine being your age. I know the way I was at that age, it would have probably pissed me off a little bit. I'd been like, but at the same time, what a valuable lesson you got, you know?
I never forgot it, and I do not hate him at all for it. I didn't hate him then. I was just like, oh, yeah, no, man, you know, you're right about that. And okay, what do I do now? You know, that was right. The toughest thing is okay, you know, I've had my sights set on this type of playing for a couple of years now. I'm really proud of my growth and I'm getting a lot of accolades from my drumming buddies. You know, I mean, that's the reason Rob even had anything to say about me, because he thought I was able to, you know, he was impressed by, you know, my, I don't know, my fills or whatever. But yeah, it's like, okay, now what? We got to think about that, you know, and that's staring at yourself in the mirror, you know, going, okay, what do you want to be good at? What is going to be and it's hard to know the choice at that age. You don't know, you know, so there's a little bit of analysis paralysis for me back then. Hell, I still go through that from time to time, but you know, what kind of drummer do I want to be? And if I kind of feel like I need to know that now, because I know how long it takes to acquire skill. And I also know that it's very difficult to acquire a lot of different skills and a lot of different broad at the same time, right? So I kind of did feel the need to focus. Okay, what direction do I want to go? And I ultimately chose feel over chops, even though I have a lot of chops stuff out there from the early 90s. I that's I left it back. I left that there.
Well, and you do both as well as anyone. And it's I think it's great for all of us folks that dig what you do to go back and see, I guess, your evolution as a drummer, right? To from back then to even stuff that you've done in the past few years. I mean, it's just been a constant. I can tell you are constantly trying to improve your craft and be the best version of you as a drummer that you can be.
I definitely try to do that. I'm still working on that. You know, whenever I sit down to behind the drums, I'm, you know, the mindset is still the same, you know, as it was in the Skin Deep days, you know?
Yeah.
How does this feel?
Yeah. You know? So in the few minutes we have left, I wanted to ask you about this other cool career that you have as Tom Knight, the voiceover artist. How did all of that start? And what are some of the really fun gigs you've gotten to do in that role?
So it started off, you know, after the TLC tour, I was trying to market myself and I learned that electronic press kits were the rage, you know, basically video demo. So, you know, I that's how I got into video production, and it attracted the attention of some local businesses. I would start working at those businesses as an editor. It's a longer story that I'll save for another podcast. But I met a guy named Ty Tauris, and we got along instantly. And I would, you know, I would start accompanying him on road gigs where we'd go and, you know, load up a truck and go do these big shoots at these sports facilities, right? So his big thing was sports editing, right? Sports shows. And along those road trips, I'd just pull out some character voices, you know, and he'd be in the driver's seat rolling, you know. And I'm not a comedian, but he just thought it was funny. And he says, you know, you might be good at, I wonder if you could do this John Facenda thing, you know. And so he would send me some old NFL films. And he's like, it would be cool if we could get a voice that kind of sounded like that. He's no longer with us. And I don't even know if we could afford him, even if he was, you know. Long story short, I was able to some degree get that vibe. And so I started working with him. He would send me script after script, I mean, hundreds of scripts, you know, and that started my voiceover career from just a chance meeting, you know. And one of the things that we did together won an Emmy. I earned an Emmy award for one of those. I had no idea. He calls me up and says, you won an Emmy. And I'm like, did you call the right guy? Did you mean to call somebody else? You butt dial me, you know. And he showed me a picture and I'm like, it was the longest week of my life waiting for him to come home from that trip, because it was like a week in Michigan or something. Great Lakes is where that Emmy came from. Great Lakes. And yeah. And so from there, I made it official. At that point, I was like, okay, I clearly need to be doing this. This is wow. Okay. You know, build a website and started taking classes, because I had no coursework. I had no idea what I was doing. I was just doing what I was told, you know, and trying my best to nail it. So I started working with Nancy Wolfson. I finished her whole course in a couple of years. She's an LA-based, high-profile vocal coach. Love her to death. Very tough. You want to talk about a tough teacher, man. Strict, and I don't want to say mean, but I mean, cut right through you, right? No punches pulled at all. So you learn very fast. I got an agent here, Houghton Talent, still with them. And some of the cooler jobs that I've done, Bose. I did something for Bose through my agency. Also, Georgia Lottery, Disney. Let's see, Crown Royal. When Crown Royal, when the Spirits ban was lifted from NFL, I don't know, half a decade ago or something, Crown Royal reached out to me directly. I had to fish them over to my agent. But they wanted to advertise. They wanted to be one of the first ones to advertise in the Super Bowl. And so they reached out to me because I could do the John Facenda kind of NFL films voice, right? And they were like, we want you to do that for at the end of our ad. And they had some ad that year, Crown Royal, the Water Boys. The Water Boys were like a sports, you know, like a team of people who would come up and, you know, squirt water in your mouth, you know, in between shots to try and, you know, maybe dilute what you're drinking and, you know, slow you down a little bit, you know, the Water Boys, you know. And so I got to go, you know, down to Crawford post-production where all the big stuff happens and do a quick, you know, 30-minute session with Crown Royal. I've had a lot of really cool gigs, man, like that, you know. And I'm still doing it, you know, to this day. I get, you know, sometimes I've got a couple of clients that send me stuff every month or every week. And then I still audition here and there and land some things.
You doing everything out of your house now?
Yeah, unless it's a big client. Big clients will generally pay the big studios. You know, Kentucky Derby was one. Schlaglox was another one. Identity Guard was another one. Crown Royal, you know, Bose. Those were jobs that every time it ended, you know, landed me either at Crawford Post or the old Doppler. Yeah. Studios, you know.
Yeah. And I imagine, just like as we're talking about the disciplines of learning a musical instrument, there's so much that we don't think about, the collective we don't think about in terms of voiceover, as far as diction and phrasing and understanding, you know, shedding any sort of accent that you may have. I mean, there's a lot of things you have to think about as a voiceover artist.
You do. I think... The people who are really, really good the coaches out there, let me say it that way. The coaches out there are almost always able to identify where I am, like where I live, even from the way I sound. Kind of like that movie, I forget what the movie is, where, you know, some dialect coach was able to, you know, pinpoint what city, you know, somebody's in, just from listening to the way they sound. But I, to your point, I did develop. So when I pull the mic down, there is a sort of a shift that happens in my mind, certainly in my throat, in my mouth, you know, depending on the read. Sometimes you can let a little bit of accent come through. Sometimes they even ask for that. So you can kind of let that, in my case, what would be a southern drawl, you can let that out a little bit. But for the most part, they want non-regional dialect. Yeah. Meaning it doesn't belong anywhere. And that's hard to do, you know, and still maintain a kind of a realness to yourself. Because right. The minute you, that's the problem with putting on a vocal mask, so to speak, is that it can stiffen things up and make it sound like you're reading as opposed to just communicating. Because that's the goal of any voice artist, at least now, you know, unless it's a movie trailer where the intent is to, you know, sound like that, have that sound or promo sound. The intent is to engage with an audience member in a way that it sounds like you're their friend. And so sometimes the copy that you're reading can mess that up for you. You can have all the right sounds and delivery, but what you're reading is nothing anyone would ever say if they were being real with you. And that's a copy problem. But you can't fix that, so you just do the best you can. But a lot of times when you get, you know, like a really well-written script where somebody actually bothered to read it out loud, because you can write for reading and then you could write for voicing. A lot of times voice scripts are written as though they were going to be read, like with the eyes, right? You know what I mean? But when you go to say them, when you go to say these words, it doesn't sound right. And you, as a voice artist, can't just change that. Some clients are okay with it, but most want you to read it as it. So they're, you know, you hit some hurdles here and there. But keeping a non-regional dialect and a very real face-to-face sound, that's the job. It's not about the microphone. It's not about how deep your voice is. You know, all the stuff that a lot of entry-level voice artists think that it is, it's not. It's, can you act? It's acting. It's really acting. Can you make it through the copy and make and pretend that you thought of those words and that you're saying them the way I'm saying them to you now? And by the way, I'm pausing here and there and taking breaths and, you know, even stammering a little bit. Some of that stuff is natural and they'll cut that stuff out. But what they really want is that absolute next guy next door, girl next door, relatable sound.
What I think is interesting about that, as I'm hearing you describe it, there's so much of a beautiful parallel between that world and this musical world that you've lived so long in, and that younger players get so wrapped up in what kind of drum heads that they have or what ply their kick drum is or what metal the snare drum's made out of, when ultimately it's like, can you groove, man? Can you have a musical conversation with someone? That's the most important part of all of this. It's the same thing.
I totally agreed. The minute you slap a mic on a drum and run it through even the most modest EQ and effect, it's changed the sound anyway. Arguably, you want that, you know, cleaner, crisper. You know, there's always elements in the recording that you probably don't want. So subtractive EQ becomes a thing and you're carving out ugly frequencies. It ends up not sounding exactly like itself anyway. Somebody said once to me, I forget who, that, you know, when you finally get to that last 5% of, you know, whatever, going from 95% excellence to 100% excellence, that's a really, despite the fact that it's a small percentage, it's a really huge cavernous leap and it often at great expense to get there when it might not even really be that necessary. If you work on your craft, if you work on your touch, your feel, your ability to sink into the music, as a voice artist, if you work on your relatability, if you work on your ability to read the words without stumbling, if you write, those are the things. It's less important to worry about the mic. It's less important to worry about what effects you're going to use. They're going to change all that anyway. They're going to put their spin on it. Can you sell the product? The microphone you're using is not going to sell the product.
No.
The space you're working in, the effects you use, your DAW, what kind of plugins you have, whether or not you use Monster Cable, that stuff doesn't sell the product, man. Nobody cares.
It's the performance.
It's the performance. Every time,
it's the performance. Yeah.
So you can enhance it in that last 5% if you want. Like I won that Emmy on this $200 Rode mic right here that I still have 23 years later in a closet. In a coat closet back before I had a bona fide studio. Nobody cares. Yeah. I could have bought a $6,000 manly modded out, something, and it wouldn't. I mean, some audiophile would probably be able to tell the difference. I'm sure they would be able to tell the difference, but that's not going to get me any jobs.
Yeah. And it's not going to make someone go and buy that product anymore than you using the microphone that's sitting in front of you,
That's exactly right. Can I sell it? If I can sell it, I can sell it on any mic.
Yeah, that's
it. I should be able to. That's the goal.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. Man. All right, Tom. Man, I can't thank you enough for hanging out with me today. This is, it's been good to just catch up with you, and I miss you. I miss hanging out, man, with you.
Oh, man, it's been great. I miss you too, brother. I miss the coffee chats in between services at the couch with the little blueberry scones and the and Bill tappity. He would just never quit. His fingers would just
That's right. He was always tapping.
Yeah.
Oh, and us, good times. Ascending Mystery Science Theater.
Mystery Science Theater. And then Gary's jokes.
That's right. The collective exhale.
The collective sigh that we all just, we love him to death, man. Good times, brother.
Best of luck to you. Love to the family. And
thank you.
Thanks for hanging out today, man. I appreciate
Likewise. It. Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Bandwidth Tapes. I'm your host, Brad Williams. The show's theme is called Playcation and was written by Mark Mundy. Drop me a line at the email address, thebandwitchtapes@gmail.com. Make sure to subscribe to receive new episodes of the podcast. And while you're at it, please tell someone else about the show. Thanks for listening.